Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for bringing us together to worship you, to study your word. We pray that you'll guard my thoughts and my actions and guide them. We pray that as we look through the history of not only what we see in Daniel, but what we see out in the world, Father, that we won't, that the message won't get lost on us, Father, that message that, you know, everything we see around us is one day going to pass away and your kingdom will be established forever. Until that time, Father, we pray you'll guide us. You'll help us to understand your will for our lives. And we come to you and ask all these things in Yahshua's name. So say amen and hallelujah. You may all be seated. Do I have control? All right. And I'm going to keep an eye on my ice water because things get dry up here sometimes. Most of you, hopefully all of you within the sound of my voice, have heard about the Dead Sea Scrolls. You probably know that the Dead Sea Scrolls were a lot of ancient scrolls and fragments found in some caves in the Middle East. They've been mentioned up here several times in the past. Some of you may know why the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls was so important. You may realize how hard it is for us to come across an ancient biblical text. And by ancient, I mean more than 2,000 years ago. So yes, if you're doing the math, I'm talking about the Old Testament, because 2,000 years ago, the New Testament, as we know it today, hadn't been written down for us yet. But these ancient texts were sitting in some caves waiting to be discovered for hundreds of years, up until they were just found only about 75 years ago. Some of the scrolls and fragments were much older than anything we had before that, even much older than the sources we had for our English Bibles. What follows is an excerpt from a page on the Library of Congress site about the Dead Sea Scrolls. And what I have on the slide is a photo of some of the caves at Qumran, and also a map that kind of shows you where Qumran is in relation to Jerusalem, to Bethlehem, to Jericho. You might know, you might have heard of those cities. Maybe you didn't know Qumran there was right on the edge or close to the Dead Sea. And you can see Cave 1, Cave 4, Cave 11 are all highlighted there. So yeah, there are several caves here. But here's the excerpt. In 1947, again, that was about 75 years ago, young Bedouin shepherds, and you've heard about Bedouins, these were a nomadic people, and they were basically desert dwellers. In fact, I think that's where that word Bedouin comes from. It comes from a word that means that they dwell in the desert. But they were searching for a stray goat in the Judean desert, and they entered a long, untouched cave and found jars filled with ancient scrolls. That initial discovery by the Bedouins yielded seven scrolls and began a search that lasted nearly a decade and eventually produced thousands of scroll fragments from 11 caves. During those same years, archaeologists searching for a habitation close to the caves that might help identify the people who deposited the scrolls excavated the Qumran ruins, a complex of structures located on a barren terrace between the cliffs where the caves were found and the Dead Sea. Within a fairly short time after their discovery, historical, paleographic, and linguistic evidence, as well as carbon-14 dating, established that the scrolls and the Qumran ruin dated from the 3rd century BCE to 68 CE. This is all before the time of Yahshua and the disciples. They were indeed ancient, coming from the late Second Temple period, a time when Yahshua of Nazareth lived. They are older than any other surviving manuscripts of the Hebrew Scriptures by almost 1,000 years. 1,000 years is a long time. And one of the most important finds was a nearly complete Isaiah scroll. I'm going to put this up on the slide here. And this Isaiah scroll is so important because it gave us a chance to see how good the scribes were at preserving the texts as they copied from one scroll to the other. And as it turns out, they were pretty good at it. Having this much older copy of Isaiah made historians and us more confident that these later versions that we used for our Bibles were accurate. By the way, so you see the great Isaiah scroll here. It's been dated at older than 1000 BCE. So there's kind of a range of dates there, but it's all these dates usually are dated around 1000 BCE, 100 years before Yahshua, or even older than that. One other thing I learned as I was studying this, that fragment name up there, that's what you can search for if you want to review the whole scroll, and they have a real nice interface online where you can go to a particular verse and it'll translate it for you. This excerpt is from Isaiah 53, but I wanted to point out the naming convention here. So 1Q means that it was found in cave 1 at Qumran, and this is one of the Isaiah scrolls. And there's a little prefix that says A, and sometimes if they found a series of scrolls or fragments from the same book, they'll put A, B, C, D. And so that's like the easy-to-use name for us to understand. So later when we get into Daniel, I might give you a quiz and see if you can figure out what cave the Daniel fragments came from. But here we have an Isaiah scroll that was dated well before the time of Yahshua. And as we all know, there's a lot of prophecy in Isaiah that points to Yahshua. And so I really could have focused on the book of Isaiah. Last week, Elder Allen talked a little bit about how unlikely, astronomically unlikely, it would have been for all of these messianic prophecies in Isaiah and even in the other books to be fulfilled by Yahshua just by chance alone. So knowing that we have an almost complete scroll of Isaiah that is dated from a time before Yahshua should really excite us. But also, this showed that the later Hebrew scrolls that we have are pretty accurate. I mean, 1,000 years, you know, has passed, and this process of copying these scrolls down, it basically proved that it worked. So why Daniel, though? Why am I focused so interested in Daniel? A few years ago, when we studied the 12 minor prophets in the YRM Bible study, I became really interested in Daniel because of the detailed accounts in the later chapters of Daniel. Often we kind of brush over them because they're not as exciting as the earlier stories. But in the later chapters of Daniel, there are very detailed accounts that historians have matched up to actual historic characters. And so here are the reasons why. Daniel has very specific prophecies that line up with accepted history. Okay, so we've got other books that do that too. Why is Daniel so special? Well, the earliest evidence that we have now of Daniel is dated very close to when those prophecies were fulfilled. And I'll talk about why that's important. And then finally, there's other evidence that points to these prophecies that are in Daniel being written by Daniel, the character Daniel, way before these prophecies were fulfilled. And so I'm going to present some of that evidence today. I'm talking about dates. I'm going to talk a lot about dates. I'll show you a little mini timeline. But, you know, I was thinking what dates are kind of interesting when we start talking about this, or even when we're looking in any accounts in the Bible. You know, I'd like to know maybe when did the author live? We know when Daniel lived. But if we know when the author lived, we can understand what other events were happening around them in the historic context in which they were writing. It's also good to know what date was that author writing about. Sometimes they're writing about stuff that's already happened, so it's like a historic book. Sometimes they're writing about current events. In prophecy, they're writing about future events, you know, and Daniel's got a lot of prophecy in it. So it's good for us to ask questions like, you know, if this is a prophecy in the future, was it fulfilled? Is it still left to be fulfilled? We've got lots of examples of that in the Bible where prophecies have not been fulfilled yet. And then finally, the question that I want to answer about Daniel today is, what is the oldest evidence that we have of these manuscripts or of these writings? We obviously don't have any of the original writings where Daniel may have sat there and written it out or maybe ascribed it or that he was dictating to. We don't have any of the originals. What we have are copies of the originals. But what is the oldest copy that we have? So these dates are interesting to me. By the way, do you want to take a peek at the oldest surviving texts that I could find from Hebrew? These are called the Ketef Hinnom scrolls, and they're actually silver scrolls. From what I can tell, they were probably worn as an amulet, but you can see the dating puts them at like around 600 BCE, which again, like think 600 years before Yahshua. So this would have been around the time I think the time of Judah, I think Judah was still a kingdom. This was almost around the time when Babylon was going to come in and take over Judah. But I mean, so you still had probably kings of Judah that were reigning at this time. And you might notice, if you look closely, it's so ancient that it uses the old Paleo-Hebrew script, which a lot of us aren't super familiar with. But you'll see there's a translation on the side that uses the more familiar Hebrew block script. And if you translate that, what you find out is that there are passages here from the Aaronic blessing, the blessing that that our elders, you're going to hear it by the end of the feast. The elders take this blessing, I think it's from number 6. Yeah, and so anyway, you've got Hebrew here on these amulets, and this is the oldest that I could find, the oldest evidence of biblical text. And again, this was probably worn as an amulet. It's a silver scroll. But I'm here to talk about Daniel. So let's take a look at a few of the fragments I found. I didn't find them. I mean, they're online. You can find them yourself. But this one is known as 4Q 112, or 4Q Daniel C. So which cave do you think that was found in? The fourth cave, right? Yeah, and you can see this particular set of fragments, the prefix or the suffix on there says C. So you can imagine there's an A, there's a B, there's a C. I think it goes down to G or H or something like this. So there were multiple Daniel fragments. But this one interests me the most. How old is this fragment? The reason it interests me is because it's from the chapters in Daniel. There's two reasons that interest me. These chapters in Daniel, chapter 10 and chapter 11, are very detailed accounts of prophecies that were going to be fulfilled and that we can now look back and see how the fulfillment, how everything lined up. But the second reason these interest me is because of their age and because they are the most ancient or the oldest fragments of Daniel that we found in Qumran. Again, when I say we, I mean modern humans, not me. I didn't find these. I found these online. I pulled this detailed image from a library called the Leon Levy Dead Sea Scrolls Digital Library. So if you want to go out there, they've got a ton of other really high detailed images. This fragment is fragment 3. Again, it's a set of 3, but this is the third one I've just kind of zoomed in on a little bit. But this is from Daniel 11. So how old is this? From what I can tell, we read earlier that, you know, these scrolls were dated using carbon 14 dating, using a paleographic analysis, which means that I think what it means is that humans kind of compare this to other ways of writing at that time, and kind of they can kind of say, okay, this is from this kind of time frame. You know, they can't get to it in the exact year, obviously, but this has been estimated to be from the first to second century BCE. So this is 100 to 200 years before Yahshua. And for the sake of this presentation, when I show you the timeline, I just picked right down the middle. I went with 150 BCE. But admittedly, I mean, there could be, you know, a variance there of about 100 years. What is interesting is the other Daniel fragments found at the same cave were dated to be closer to the time of Yahshua's ministries. And what's fascinating to think is that we have found fragments or scrolls now that could have been being copied by a scribe that was living right there when Yahshua and the disciples were walking around. So here's a mini timeline to explain why that date that I just mentioned is interesting to me. So I've got a timeline here. It spans about 1,000 years. It starts with King David. I've just anchored it back in King David. He's not going to be important to this, but just know that this is a time span that goes from King David all the way out to Yahshua's ministry. So in between here, you've got the history of Israel, the history of Judah, the history of the split kingdoms. And I've put a little point on there just to say, you know, here's where the Assyrians came and they captured the northern kingdom of Israel. All right. And then I put Daniel in Babylon. He falls around 605 BCE. So we think that that's when he was carried off to Babylon. And that's about the time that Babylon captured Jerusalem, destroyed the temple. And that's been dated around 586 BCE. Now, There's a couple of other characters that I've listed out here, and they're going to be important for a few reasons that you're going to find out. One of them is Alexander the Great. Many of us have heard about Alexander the Great. He was a Greek ruler. Well, I don't want to give anything away, so I'm going to hold off. And then Antiochus Epiphanes. So some of you say Antiochus. I'm going to say Antiochus Epiphanes. And let me show you where this fragment was dated. If you look at Antiochus Epiphanes, we know that he was ruling around the time of 167 BCE, but the official dating for this fragment that we're finding from Daniel was dated within 25 or 50 years of that. In fact, based on the 150 BC dating, I mean, it looks like it was within 20 years, right? So why is this important? I don't know. I feel like I've already drawn the lines for you, but it's important because now we've got evidence of an ancient Daniel, and we're going to talk about the prophecies in a few minutes, but this character, Antiochus Epiphanes, Daniel goes into a lot of prophetic detail about stuff that lines up with this character, Antiochus Epiphanes. And what this shows is that we've got fragments from around that time, and these were copies of the original, right? So you'll see this timeline again. Since we're talking about Daniel, what I thought I'd do is I'd break it down very high level, very quick. Daniel has 12 chapters. Some chapters are more interesting for this conversation than other chapters. But, if you start in chapter 1, you get the story about Daniel and his friends being taken off to Babylon, being blessed with wisdom and understanding. And Daniel you'll see that Daniel, as a Jew even, is rising up in the ranks there of in the Babylonian courts. Chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar's dream about a great statue representing future kingdoms. And I wasn't going to focus so much on chapter 2, because remember, we got to get to chapter 11. But I think it's good to pause here for something, because this image represented kingdoms that were going to come, right? And so Nebuchadnezzar had this dream. He asked Daniel to interpret it for him. So I've went through and listed what these kingdoms were. So the first one, the head of gold, represented Babylon. Okay, that's the kingdom that was active when Daniel was giving this prophecy, was explaining this prophecy. The next is the breast of silver for Media and Persia. Again, that takeover of Media and Persia happened during Daniel's lifetime. We find out about that in Daniel. So those two shouldn't be super surprising for us to find, in a book of prophecy. Again, according to the narrative, Daniel prophesied about this before it happened, but this did happen during Daniel's timeline. But now we get into the thighs of brass representing Greece, and this is stuff then that would have come after Daniel. And then finally, the legs of iron, which represented Rome. Now, Daniel does not specifically mention Greece or Rome in this prophecy, which is why I didn't want to focus on chapter 2. There's not a lot of detail here, right? We're just given this image, and we're told about these kingdoms that are coming. Now, looking back, we can see that they represented Greece and Rome. But I think the most important thing I want to talk about is Rome here. So let's look again at this timeline. So Rome wasn't even, Rome was just coming into power shortly before Yahshua was born, right? And so we've got this official dating now, 150 years before Yahshua, and this prophecy here in chapter 2 and in other chapters is prophesying about a kingdom that hasn't even come yet based on the official dating. So let's get rid of Antiochus Epiphanes for a second so I can make room for the Roman Empire. So the Roman Empire is there, and let me see. I've got a date here that I can give you, too, for chapter 2. The first Roman emperor of Rome was Augustus Caesar, also known as Gaius Octavius, who took the title Augustus in 27 BCE, so before Yahshua's ministry, basically, about 30 years before Yahshua's ministry. And so all of this stuff was happening after this fragment was copied, based on the dates that we have. Continuing on in chapter 3, this is the story about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego being saved from the fiery furnace. Really exciting stories. Chapter 4 is about Nebuchadnezzar's dream, about a great tree that warned of his upcoming madness, and then later Nebuchadnezzar acknowledges Yahweh's reign. Chapter 5 is about Belshazzar. He's another ruler in Babylon. His feast is interrupted by a mysterious writing on the wall that predicted Babylon's fall. Chapter 6 is about Daniel in the lion's den. Hopefully everyone in this room knows that story about Daniel in the lion's den, chapter 6. And chapter 7, Daniel has a vision of four beasts representing future kingdoms and the coming of the Son of Man. So I did not intend to spend a lot of time on this, but these beasts, we believe that they align with those other kingdoms that I just talked about from chapter 2. You know what, too? I want to go back to chapter 6, because this doesn't mention that in chapter 6, the Medes have taken over. So Babylon has fell, and the Medes and Persians are now expanding and have taken over. It is mentioned in chapter 6. There's a new ruler in town, and, you know, so just notice that. If you go through Daniel, this is where the transition happens between Babylon and the Medes and the Persians. But back to chapter 7. So, again, these beasts align, we believe, looking back, like the lion, for example, aligns with Babylon, the bear with the Medes and the Persians, okay, who were in rule at the time. The leopard represented Greece, and then Rome was a beast with 10 horns. And again, those 10 horns, you know, I don't even think I mentioned the ten toes. I feel like I should go back and mention that, because I don't want to miss out on the feet of iron and clay. So those are the 10 divided nations. And we've had whole sermons up here about those 10 divided nations. I recommend you go back. Elder Randy does a good message about the 10 divided nations and what that means. And then you've got this big rock that's coming in to destroy them that represents the kingdom of Yahweh being set up, you know, wiping out all the nations of the earth. Okay, so sorry for jumping around. I'm going to go back to chapter 7. And again, you've got these four beasts, which represent these four big empires. And then the ten horns, we believe, kind of match up with those ten toes. But again, this is kind of vague, right? I mean, we're basically just talking about four kingdoms. Chapter 8, Daniel sees a vision of a ram and a goat. And these symbolize the Persian and Greek empires. He actually mentions those empires by name. Yes, he mentions Greece by name in chapter 8. So I believe Greece was around back then and had started to influence the nations, but they still hadn't risen to power in Daniel's lifetime. Okay, so we're on chapter 8. Let me just take a quick... By the way, in chapter 8, there's a large horn that Daniel talks about that is thought to represent Alexander the Great. Remember, I just mentioned him, who was on that mini timeline. Daniel describes Alexander's kingdom being split into four, which is what happens if you go back and look at history. So chapter 8 talks about that. But this little horn, I wanted to pause here because this is the first time that we believe we get a specific reference to Antiochus Epiphanes. With a little horn, and he was a king that ruined that reigned during the Seleucid Empire, who desecrated the temple. And I guess since we're here, I actually have a passage up here, and it's really small text. So this is from Daniel 8, and the reason I wanted to go into these couple of verses is because, again, we look back and we see that this little horn represented Antiochus Epiphanes. It says in Daniel 8, verse 12, because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth to the ground, and he did all of this and prospered. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, how long will it be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot? And he said to me, for 2,300 days, then the sanctuary will be cleansed. So we do have historic accounts of this happening during the time of the Maccabees, and we actually have accounts written down for us in Maccabees 1 and 2. So because we're going to focus a little bit on Antiochus Epiphanes and kind of establish him as this character, especially when we get to Daniel 11, I wanted to just read a couple paragraphs about the historic account. So in 167 BCE, during the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes, he was a Seleucid king who ruled over the region that included Judea. The Jewish people faced religious persecution. Antiochus IV, So Antiochus IV is another name for Antiochus Epiphanes. He issued decrees that prohibited Jewish religious practices, including the observance of the Sabbath, circumcision, and the study of Torah. A few years later, a group of Jewish rebels led by Judah Maccabee, also known as Judah the Hammer, and his brothers initiated a revolt against the Seleucid forces and sought to regain control of Jerusalem and the Second Temple. After several years of fighting, the Jewish rebels successfully recaptured Jerusalem in 164 BCE. Once Jerusalem was back in Jewish hands, the Maccabees cleansed and rededicated the temple, which had been desecrated by the Seleucids. This rededication is what Hanukkah, which means dedication or renewal, commemorates. So all of us have heard about Hanukkah. Well, this is the story that led to Hanukkah, Antiochus Epiphanes coming in. According to tradition, during the rededication of the temple, there was only enough sacred oil to light the menorah for one day, but miraculously it burned for 8 days until more oil could be prepared. This miracle is the basis for the 8-day celebration of Hanukkah. Now at the bottom, you see there it says 2,300 days. I haven't found a satisfactory explanation about what those days represent. If you take them as literal days, it's a little over 6 years, about 6 1/3 years. And some people have tried to fit that into when Antiochus Epiphanes came in and he trampled the temple and then it was rededicated. But based on historic accounts, that was only like 3 years or so. However, I did realize that if you count the years from the death of the high priest who was serving at that time, then the numbers match up a little bit better. It looks like it was 6 to 7 years. So it's possible that those 2,300 days could be literal and then, you know, could have started with the death of this high priest up until the time the temple was rededicated. But again, a lot of people are split on that. But it's almost unmistakable that Daniel here is referencing Antiochus Epiphanes in Daniel 8. Again, he talks about the daily sacrifices, the transgression of desolation, and then we have historic accounts of this actually happening. Oh, and here's the timeline again. Just to remind you, Antiochus Epiphanes is there. Official dating of this fragment that I was showing you earlier, really close to that. Let me see. Oh, and then I wanted to go to Maccabees 1 to confirm this account. So Maccabees, the book of Maccabees actually names Antiochus by name. So Maccabees 1, verse 20, and then I'm going to jump down to verse 54. After subduing Egypt, Antiochus returned in the 143rd year. And I didn't double check this, but I think they're talking about the year of the Seleucid Empire. I should double check that, though. He went up against Israel and came to Jerusalem with a strong force. And then in verse 54, it talks about what Daniel prophesied here. In the 15th year of Chislev, in the 145th year, they erected a desolating sacrilege on the altar of burnt offering, and they also built altars in the surrounding towns of Judah. So here we have a historic account written in Maccabees of something that took place that Daniel prophesied. So if we jump to chapter 9, this is a prayer of Daniel that leads to a prophecy about 70 weeks. And if you get into the details, it's broken up into like 62 weeks and then weeks after that. But, you know, 70 weeks is about 490 years. And a lot of people can show, and it's not hard to show, that this seems to point to the coming Messiah, to Yahshua coming. So, you know, if you go into chapter 9, you go down to like verse 24, 25, it talks about the 70 weeks and the 62 weeks. And so, again, this could be used as evidence that now we've got Daniel, a copy of Daniel that predates Yahshua, and you've got these 70 weeks that point over to Yahshua. And that 70 weeks started with a decree that allowed the Jews to go back and rebuild. So I think that's what Daniel's talking about, that 70 weeks. And he talks about an anointed one, right? So it's really interesting, and I could have focused on this a little bit more. But again, I mean, we all believe in Yahshua. We all believe that even Isaiah prophesied of Yahshua. And so this does lend credibility to Daniel being written being true prophecy, right, under inspiration. Chapter 10 talks about spiritual battles, and then Daniel gets spiritual battles to lay a vision for Daniel, and Daniel has this vision of a man dressed in linen, very futuristic type vision. Finally, though, we're getting to chapter 11, and here we get a detailed prophecy of historical events that led up to Antiochus Epiphanes, and then we get prophecies about these things that Antiochus Epiphanes did. And there's a lot of detail in here, and this is what I think causes secular historians to be so concerned. I mean, there's so much detail in here that aligns to history that, you know, you either have to believe that Daniel received these prophetic visions under inspiration from Yahweh, or you have to try to say that Daniel was written after all these prophecies, right? Which is what they're trying to do. And sometimes I worry that the dating that we have on these is affected by that because, you know, of course, you can't have something written before it was ever fulfilled, right? Or copied even before it was ever fulfilled. And since none of us here that I know of have doctorates in history, what I've tried to do is summarize, and this is very small. I don't know if you'll, maybe you'll be able to see this. Well, what I've tried to do is summarize chapter 11 and kind of point out sections in chapter 11 and how they correspond to actual events that have been recorded and that happened. So chapter 11 in verse 2 talks about a fourth Persian king that stirred up against Greece. We now know that that applied to Xerxes of Persia, who invaded Greece. And again, this all of these verses here would have happened after Daniel's lifetime. Every single one of them after Daniel's lifetime. Verse 3 mentions a warrior king, which now we look back to and say, oh, well, that was Alexander the Great. He's the one that came and expanded the Greek Empire. He was a conqueror. Verse 4 goes on to talk about how that kingdom was going to be divided. I mentioned that a little earlier ago. Divided towards the four winds of heaven, and Alexander's empire was split. And the two kingdoms that I want to focus on are the, one of them was called the Ptolemaic kingdom, which was in the south, and the Seleucid kingdom in the north. And it's important to highlight those because the rest of the chapter kind of talks about this battle between the north and the south and kind of goes through the history here. So if you go down to chapter 11, verses 5 through 20, if you want to do this on your own time, you can read about the conflicts between the north and the south kingdom. Again, these were the Ptolemaic rulers and the Seleucid empires clashing together. They were trying to consolidate power through marriage, through political marriages, through military campaigns. And then it continues on to talk in verse 21 about a contemptible person who breaks other armies and plunders. And this is where we find Antiochus Epiphanes introduced. Again, Daniel doesn't call him by name. So we have to look back now and say, oh, this is obviously talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. And I'm going to show you since we're not going into chapter 11 in detail, what I want to do is show you two very specific details. I just picked two verses out of there to show you the level of detail that Daniel went into and why this is so concerning for secular historians. Verses 25 through 39 talk about these continued conflicts between the king, again, this would be Antiochus Epiphanes, and the southern kingdom. And we have historic reference, we have historic knowledge of him battling against the Ptolemies, Ptolemaic Empire. Yeah. Chapter 11 and verses 25 through 39 also prophecy about the profaning of the temple. It's something we just covered from Maccabees. The desecration of the temple in 167 BCE. Finally, the chapter kind of wraps up with talking about continued battles between the north and the south. There's a lot of debate over whether this was fulfilled or if it has future fulfillment. So I haven't put anything in that block for the historic account there. But again, that's the end of chapter 11. So now that I've summarized it, let's look at a couple of the details that make this chapter very, very interesting. I'm going to look first at verse number 17. So chapter 11, 17. And I've got a picture here of Antiochus the Third. So we've been talking about Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth, but this is the Third, so this is a predecessor. It says in verse 17, he will determine to come with the might of his entire kingdom and will make an alliance with the king of the south. And he will give him a daughter in marriage in order to overthrow the kingdom, but his plans will not succeed or help him. And we have specific examples of this ruler, Antiochus III, offering his daughter Cleopatra in marriage to Ptolemy V, Ptolemy Epiphanes V. And this happened around the time of 200 to 180 BCE. So again, a couple hundred years before Yahshua. Here's the second example. And this is one that more of you are probably familiar with. Verse 31 talks about... This is Antiochus Epiphanes, and again, I've got a coin here with his image on it, Antiochus Epiphanes. In verse 31, it says, his armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and will abolish the daily sacrifice, and then they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. This sounds a little bit like what we just heard about. What's that in chapter 8? Anyways, it's what was written about in the Maccabees, too. So Antiochus IV, in an attempt to suppress Jewish religious practices, entered the Jewish temple in 167 BCE. So that's the date that I've chose for the timeline, 167 BCE. He sacrificed a pig on the altar, erected an idol to Zeus and within the temple, and an event known as the Abomination of Desolation. So these are specific examples from chapter 11 of very specific historic events that line up to very specific historic characters. And this is why if you're trying to prove that Daniel was written, you have to prove that Daniel was written after this. Otherwise, you know that he was given inspiration from Yahweh, right? Here's the timeline again. Again, I want to keep reminding you that we were just reading accounts about Antiochus Epiphanes. And again, this dating of the copy of Daniel happened really close in proximity to this. Let's see here. Okay, chapter 12 ends, the book ends, the book of Daniel ends with a prediction of end times, resurrection, and the fate of the righteous and the wicked. And we've spent a lot of time now trying to understand how these prophecies lined up with the dates, and especially the dates of this fragment that we have. But here are a couple other things to consider. And I'm getting ready to wrap this up, so I think I've only got a couple pages left. Here are a couple things to consider. If the fragments that we have are from the second or first centuries BCE, the originals must have been older. In addition to this, again, this kind of lends credibility to this idea of an older Daniel. Because we found different fragments there in the caves, we know that it was a popular book, right? And different fragments of Daniel indicate a popularity of the book that would have been difficult unless Daniel was written earlier. I've also heard, now I didn't have time to put this into a slide, I've also heard that of the fragments we found, there are a couple that have some stylistic changes or different verbiage that was used in one or the other, which lends credibility to Daniel being much older and then being copied and copied and copied and copied up until this point when they were stored in these jars and put into the caves. But because... when we found them, I mean, there were some minor differences that kind of show that, you know, this was a collection from two different areas, right? And for that to happen, Daniel could not have written his book, and then 50 years later, we have all these copies from different areas and different with minute changes. So there's evidence again because Daniel was popular, and we have so many different copies of fragments. It kind of shows that. He would have basically had to have written the book earlier. It would have had to gain popularity and then later been accepted into the canon, the Jewish canon. But, And in 50 years' time from Antiochus Epiphanes to when this fragment was dated, it's just very unlikely. So again, what I'm trying to do is set the stage for Daniel being much older than that and being older than Antiochus, these events of Antiochus Epiphanes. There are some who object to the language used in Daniel. You might not realize this, but some of Daniel is written in Aramaic. Some of it is written in Hebrew. And just like any language, these languages, Aramaic and Hebrew, have evolved over time. And people will point out, oh, some of these Aramaic words that Daniel uses were borrowed from the Greek language. But if it really was Daniel, this book would have had to be written after the Greek Empire had come into full effect. And so it must have been written later. And this is where I pulled out this excellent book. I didn't even realize I had it. I saw a reference online to it, and I went into my other room, and I was like, Ellie, look at this big book. It's Kenneth Harrison, Roland Kenneth Harrison's book, Introduction to the Old Testament. And he has a chapter in there about Daniel, specifically regarding the dating of the book, and he addresses these language challenges in great detail. So there are three Aramaic words that were borrowed from Greek. They happen to refer to musical instruments, though, okay? And so what Harrison points out is, well, these words for these instruments, yeah, they were known in later times, but, you know, these words for instruments, there was a Greek influence at the time that Daniel lived. He could have easily picked up these instrument names. And, you know, I don't know if it was him that pointed this out, but even in English, we're using words for instruments that have been around for a few hundred years, like piano, for example. That term for piano has been around for 300 years, and it came from an instrument called the pianoforte, right? So it's not unlikely. It can't really be used as evidence that Daniel was written later when the Greek Empire was around. And we even saw proof of, I want to say Pythagoras. I shouldn't say anything because I should have it in my notes. We saw proof of, even older than Antiochus Epiphanes, of a Greek author using these words. So the idea that there's a problem here with, and I don't have it up on the slide, but there's a problem with these Greek words being in Daniel, is not a problem at all. I mean, these are words that were probably used for hundreds of years. There was Greek influence in at the time of Daniel in his lifetime. But what I thought was interesting is then Harrison goes on to mention these Persian words, these Persian loan words, because some people say, well, it doesn't make any sense that he was using these Persian words, because wouldn't that have been later, you know, that the Persian Empire came to be, and then maybe these words were developed from Persian words. But what he points out is, and I'll just read his quote here, the Persian terms found in Daniel are specifically old Persian words, that is to say, occurring within the history of the language to about 300 B.C., this would indicate that the Aramaic of Daniel, in this respect, at least is pre-Hellenistic. So pre-Hellenistic, what does that mean? Pre-Hellenistic, before the Greek Empire came to be, and they were trying to Hellenize Jews and take away, strip their religion away and force them all to worship like the Greeks did. So this Aramaic that we find in Daniel, he's given evidence that it is old, and it's okay that there are Persian words in there. So I thought that was super interesting. And maybe a follow-up to this sermon, like I'm trying not to be super technical here because I don't want to lose everyone, but maybe a follow-up would be to go to Harrison's text, to go through point by point and look at all of the points that people have made for a later dating of Daniel, and then all the rebuttals, because there have been so many rebuttals to all of the so-called evidence that Daniel was written late. But that sermon would definitely be technical, and I don't want to like lose everyone. Finally, I mean, I want to pull out, this is kind of like the trump card, and it almost doesn't feel fair like to do this, but just point out that Yahshua accepted Daniel as a prophet, as the prophet who prophesied about the abomination of desolation. Yahshua quoted from Daniel. He says in Matthew 25:15, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, and then in parentheses, whoever reads, let him understand. So you've got Joshua, who is confirming the validity of Daniel. And I don't have a slide for it. Also, this was kind of like something I was studying kind of late last night, so I didn't have time to prepare this. But most scholars, what I was thinking, I was like, aren't there other people that wrote in the Bible that also accepted Daniel? And yes, Ezekiel did. And the thing that I find curious is that most scholars, and this was according to Britannica.com, will accept that the book of Ezekiel is ancient. Like they'll say, oh yeah, the book of Ezekiel is from the 6th century BCE. Again, that would have been around the time that Daniel lived. And Ezekiel specifically mentions Daniel, right? He says in 28:3, this is a prophecy against the king of Tyre. He says, behold, you are wiser than Daniel. No secret is hidden from you. So you've got Daniel, who was established as a character, recognized by Ezekiel, and historians are okay with Ezekiel being dated way back then. So it's so odd that they're not okay with Daniel. And it's because of all the, I think it's because of all these detailed prophecies that he made, where everything kind of lines up with history. And they're like, well, how can that be? So we've talked about the fragments from Daniel. We've talked about their dating. We've talked about other historical evidence that give credibility to, oh, by the way, the Jewish and Christian traditions that Daniel was written way prior to the prophecies he made, right? Maybe this will kind of strengthen your faith in that. Maybe it'll make you curious about the history of Israel. But I guess I should emphasize that you shouldn't wait around for a discovery of some ancient text to prove that these prophecies were authentic. You know, our faith here is about embracing Yahweh's word and believing that something big is coming. We all believe in Yahshua, and with that should come that same acceptance that Yahshua gave to the authenticity of the Old Testament. And when Yahshua quoted here from Daniel, I'm sure he believed that this is the same Daniel that was carried off into Babylon 600 years in the past. So in closing, I want you to remember, you know, our faith should give us confidence in the things we hope for, like the second coming of Yahshua. And our faith should assure us of the things we cannot see. You know, I don't think we need this physical evidence to believe that these were inspired, these prophecies were inspired by Yahweh. And so, you know, I've got a scripture here, Hebrews 11:1. It's basically what I just said. Now, faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. So remember that faith isn't about having all the answers. I certainly don't have all the answers, but it is about knowing the one who does have the answers. May Yahweh bless you. Hallelujah.